Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. There are doses of Agatha Christie with Death on the Nile and Evil Under the Sun. Modern treats, The Brothers Bloom, Cat Person. Or how about treating yourself to masterpieces such as The African Queen or The Dambusters? This episode is a special one, as I've got a really special guest star to talk about a pair of films that remain, well, particular favourites of hers. It's writer, director, actor, producer, comedian, genius. It's Alice Lowe is joining me. Now, her screen work is already to be found in the Studio Canal catalogue, not least as co-writer and co-star of The Wonderful Sightseers, directed by Ben Wheatley. But she's about to tell us she's something of a fan of Nicholas Roeg and Julie Christie. Here's a clip from one of her two choices, far from the madding crowd, to set up our conversation.
A woman like you does more damage than she can conceivably imagine.
Please go away. I'd rather you didn't talk to me again.
I haven't been able to stop thinking about you since I first met you.
Oh.
Honestly. I loved you then, at once. And I do now.
It's not possible. There's no such sudden feeling in people.
Hello, Alice Lowe, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Simon. Thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute thrill to have you. And what doesn't come across in the audio is you've got a really spooky mirror behind you, which will hopefully add to the atmosphere of the conversation that we're going to have.
It's a little bit Ringu, isn't it? It's a little bit yeah, with the lady brushing her hair. It's
if
not
something
intentional.
Crawls out of that mirror, I am gone. This is going to be the shortest episode we've ever done.
It's not intentional. Sorry. Literally, this is the place that I found that I could sit in my house.
So we gave you the entire Studio Canal catalogue to pick from, and you zeroed in on a couple of films. Can we introduce them in chronological order? First of all, we're in the land of Far From the Madding Crowd, I believe. So can you introduce that and the people involved?
So it's the 1967 definitive, I would say, version of Far From the Madding Crowd, directed by John Schlesinger. I probably saw it on telly when I was a kid, but it's got the cream of British acting talent throughout it. But also Nicholas Roeg was the cinematographer of the film, which is very interesting.
Yeah. And so an adaptation of a book I never read at school, the Thomas Hardy book. So I came to this completely cold. And I mean, now I want to dress up as Terence Stamp and hit caterpillars with a sword, but I'll come to that shortly. You've described this as one of your favourite ever adaptations. And I'm curious as to that, as to why. How familiar were you with the book? What does this capture as an adaptation?
I mean, I'm a Thomas Hardy fan. I think he slipped out of fashion in terms of not being particularly feminist writer, but certainly I studied Tess of the D'Urbervilles at school and was completely captivated by it. And I think he deals a lot in, we'd say, iconic imagery now with cinematic. Yeah. Sort of in cinematic criticism, but you can see a lot of the scenes as he describes them, which doesn't then mean that you then make a fantastic adaptation of his work. I think his work's quite hard to translate, but I read all the books when I was young and then watched the films and was obsessed with them. And I think almost folk horror is starting to re-embrace Thomas Hardy and, you know, his links with the British landscape and you know, Tess of the D'Urbervilles happening in Stonehenge and things like that. Suddenly people are sort of starting to pay attention to it again. So I think Thomas Hardy's always due a revisit for its witchiness.
Through bushes and through briars I lately took my way, all for to hear the small birds sing and the lambs to skip and play.
But far from the madding crowd, I think it's just one of those really luminous films that you don't know quite why it's hypnotising, and it just is. Some of it is the light, the quality of the light. The cinematography is amazing. You know, you've got a genius working as a cinematographer. And I think just watching it, probably at the age I was just, it was something a bit edgier than an Austen. Do you know what I mean? There's something wilder and more. And, you know, Bathsheba Everdeen is quite a feminist character. You know, she's someone who wants to get on and do stuff.
Yeah.
She's not really chasing these guys. They're chasing her.
You should write poster quotes. Edgier than an Austen.
Edgier than an Austen.
Edgier than an Austen.
No, let's not go and see that then.
So when did you watch this? You said you watched this at a point where it was edgier than what you were exposed to at that point.
I will have just been a kid seeing it on TV. And, you know, I think I used to watch a lot of films just randomly on television. And then every now and then something would blow my mind and I'd be like, what is this? Black Narcissus? What is that? You know, and I wouldn't know that it was deemed a classic. I'd just go, oh, that's going to haunt me for the next 20 years. So I would put it in that bracket. But I also was like the first time I'd seen Terence Stamp on screen. And to me, he's just like the archetypal sort of hero, bad boy.
There's a bit in the film, because I hadn't watched the film before until I knew we were going to talk about it, where you've got Terence Stamp and Julie Christie in the same frame. And it struck me that these aren't just two incredible screen presences. They know how to work the camera. They know how to act around the camera. And I was really struck with that because they're doing so little in that. I just wonder, from an acting point of view, when you're watching something like that, do you feel like you're watching something of a masterclass?
John Schlesinger certainly was someone who was interested in personality of actors. And I think that can't be taken for granted, actually, because I think in some degrees now the Hollywood system is anti-personality in some ways. It's like someone's quirk or essence. If it comes through too strongly, it might alienate people. So they don't hire those actors. They go for the more bland choice. And I think I was looking at some interviews with Terence Stamp, and he was sort of saying how Julie Christie wasn't that interested in being an actress, but she had this strong, powerful presence. She had this state of beingness, he described it, which I thought was really fascinating because she has got sort of regal quality or something. Like, it's a very unusual quality, I think. When you try and compare her to other actresses, it's difficult to find an actress maybe in modern day that to compare her with. But, you know, there's a charisma for sure with both of them. But I do think that was to do with how directors selected their actors in those days and also how interested they were in humanity. You know, what the lens captured was human essence or human personality. And I think Roeg and Schlesinger both were masters of that.
For those not familiar with the text or the story in any form, this is fundamentally a story, he says, like failing his GCSE as he says so, where you've got three suitors for Julie Christie. And you've made the point in the past, like, why wouldn't there be three suitors for Julie Christie? Because she's just full on amazing. But you also made the point earlier about almost like a cream of British acting talent. And it's not just Terence Stamp, it's Peter Finch and Alan Bates battling for her affections.
Yeah.
Can you take us into like that first time you watch this and you seeing these three duking it out for her?
Well, obviously, it's terrifying, isn't it? You're like, is this what's on offer for me in the future? This is like the three archetypes that I get to choose from. And obviously, when you're younger, you're like, well, I'll have Terence Stamp, thanks. And then you get older and think, no, probably Gabriel Oakes, the more sensible decision, isn't it? But I don't know. I guess knowing what I know now, I look at the history of those actors and they were sort of like the great new turning point of, you know, they'd been in a lot of working class sort of new wave for British films. And so they were sort of carving the way. It must have been so exciting to go to the cinema and see like these new actors shot in this beautiful, heroic, painterly way where they were fulfilling some fantasy, I suppose, of what people might have had of those characters. And actually it wasn't well received, was it, at the time? I don't think it was badly reviewed.
It was slightly mixed,
and it was seen as a bit of a misstep for John Schlesinger. I find his name really hard to say. I apologize in advance. I'm slurring his name every time I say it. But yeah, I think I think there's a freshness to it and a quality, like, you know, as a filmmaker, it's that you need the cast to have that hunger and that essence and that sort of, you feel like you're doing something for the first time ever. And I think that's when you have a timeless film, is when the energy is captured. It's, you know, you're capturing a genie in the bottle for all time. There's just a magic, an intangible magic, and it's sort of an energy that gets captured. And that makes it a timeless film.
I envy the way you saw it for the first time, actually. Not per se seeing it on a television screen rather than a cinema screen, but you switch it on, you don't know what it is, you don't know who's in it, you don't know how long it is either. And the whole thing presumably unfolds as a complete mystery in front of your eyes.
Yeah. I guess, even then, as a child, I would have seen it as an old film. So some old films are stuffy and boring.
Mm.
And then I watched this old film and there's something rock and roll about it. You know, whether it's the Nick Roeg cinematography, whether it's like Terrence Stamp looking like one of the Libertines, I don't know. But for me, there was something exciting about it and edgy, you know, even though, you know, it's classified you, isn't it? So it's not.
Yeah, yeah.
There isn't anything really racy in it or dark particularly. Oh, but
it is the only youth certificate film in history to have the words don't be a doodle fanny in it. I don't think there's many other youth certificate films that
can claim
that.
I think there's some animals getting hurt in it possibly as well. I don't know.
There is a caterpillar.
A caterpillar may have been hurt in the scene. But, you know, I think it's one of those films that I could watch again and again, really. I'm going to try and show it to my kids, but I don't know how they'll take it, to be honest.
Do it as a surprise. That's got to be the best way to spring it on someone.
Yeah. Sometimes we just put stuff on and we pretend that there's nothing we can do about it. I don't know if you've ever done that. Or you're just like, it's just on.
Right.
We did that with The Elephant Man and they actually did watch it and liked it. So that was
hang on, back on. You pretended to your kids, and it is the law of kids that they know more about every bit of technology than the rest of us put together. And you know they were like humouring you.
They're too little. They don't know anything about technology.
Have you got ZX Spectrums in your house?
Well, I don't. We don't have much technology in the house anyway, so it'd be a miracle if they knew about tech.
I love that.
They probably will be brilliant at tech, but they don't have much exposure to it. So,
in 20 years' time, they will be on this podcast talking about The Elephant Man and just say, "You'll never guess what my mother did.
How much it traumatised them."
You mentioned the cinematography a couple of times, and it is where we bring in Nicholas Roeg, who shot the film. And I only read today, actually, it was the first 70mm film to be shown on the giant screen that opened at the time at the long-lost Odeon Marble Arch. And, I mean, just the sheer look of it is quite extraordinary. Can you take us into that a little bit and just what he was capturing that really caught your eye?
To me, it's about a spontaneity. It's, you know, there's the famous story, which I think gets done to death, about how John Schlesinger didn't like Terrence Stamp, didn't really want to film him. And so Nicholas Roeg said, there's not enough footage for this sword scene. So let's you and me go out and grab some stuff with the sword. And then it became the most iconic scene in the film. But to me, that says a lot about Nicholas Roeg, that he was an opportunist in terms of his filmmaking, that he would, if he saw good light, he would go and grab the light.
Yeah.
Which is some of the beauty of digital filmmaking now, that you can do that. But it says something about him that he was limber enough and willing enough to kind of go, let's go and grab that thing. So then you're kind of like, it seems like you're filming magic, but actually you're just someone who's smart and sees the opportunity and grabs it when it's given to you. And actually, I did meet Nicholas Roeg a couple of times. I was lucky enough to meet him.
Oh, heck.
Yeah, because I'm such a big fan. And I did sort of go, please tell me about filmmaking. How do you do it? And he said, the one thing that he said that was great, he said, if you're planning to film in the attic and you turn up at the house and it has a fabulous basement, film in the basement. And he sort of said, if you're planning to film in full sunshine and you turn up and there's rain, film in the rain, like use the rain. Like he sort of would take what was given to him by fate, you know, and go, I'm going to enjoy the beauty of whatever this is, the virtue of whatever this is. I'm going to enjoy it. And a lot of, you know, when you're actually filmmaking as an actor or whatever, there can be a good deal of waiting around because the conditions weren't what the director wanted, or you know, we didn't get the location we needed, so there's some problems with that. Or, you know, we don't like the frame, it's not working, this kind of thing. And actually, I love this idea that he kind of, there was a mischief, a sense of mischief about, let's see what goes wrong and that will be what we'll film. Because the thing that goes wrong is the gift.
Yeah.
And I love that. I love all of that.
I'm just trying to put myself into a producer's headspace there. That the point, I mean, being spontaneous when you've got a very lightweight digital camera and you can go out now is one thing. Being spontaneous when you're shooting in the 1960s on location in what, West Dorset, and following the opportunities are there, that's a real head scratcher to me.
I guess he was a rule breaker and had this sort of sense of why not, because I suppose he wasn't telling Schlesinger that he was doing this, but he knew once they got the footage in the edit that they'd fall in love with it. So that kind of roguish sensibility, which is weird. Maybe it's nominative determinism. He's a rogue and his name was Rogue. I don't know, but just that sense of mischief of like, I'm going to do this and it's going to be better than what they thought they'd got by following the rules. And I love, for me, that's my ethos as a filmmaker. I'm sort of like, let's see what you can get when you don't see the barriers, when you try not to see the barriers and actually enjoy the barrier, you know, enjoy breaking through things and doing it not in the way you're supposed to. I think that's what brings the vibrancy to it and the spontaneity to it.
So when you're directing your own film, Time Stalker, for instance, and you're using massive drapes as divisions of walls and stuff like that, is that, I mean, do we draw some kind of lineage there from like some of the things we're talking about here, that how it's informed your own filmmaking?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, for a start, he was a filmmaker that looked to the edit. You know, he thought about the edit, he knew about the edit, he saw it as part of his creative process. So I'm always like, you know, it's not so much fix it in the edit as like it will be created in the edit.
Yeah.
Like, so you just have to get as much stuff as you can when you're filming. But also, like, you know, where do you place your value in terms of, there'll be some shots that you're like, I know that if I get that shot, it's going to be iconic and it's going to be memorable and it'll be money on screen, even if it didn't cost very much. And then there's other moments that you can kind of go, we can cheat that. We can do that in a cheap way with some material and we can make that look more expensive than it is. But as long as we've got that other moment, it's fine that we've got this moment. That's what filmmaking should be.
Yeah.
Is that sense of, you know, discovery and organicness of the process, which, you know, is disappearing somewhat because of streamers and the way they very meticulously and methodically make things. And, you know, the script is sort of scrutinized before it even goes to production.
I'm fascinated how, I mean, there's conversations about one or two streamers insisting on the same point being reiterated three or four times. I'm just fascinated how that how that would work with Far From the Madding Crowd, to be honest. That would be quite interesting. The sword fight would be great.
Oh, they'd lose the sword fight. They'd just be like, that's boring. People have changed channel. The algorithms, you know, they wouldn't have the sword fight at all.
And yet for me, I mean, you said there that before, the sword fight is the bit that people remember. Tell us for those who've never seen this, what is so special about this sword fight?
I mean, it's quite trippy, I would say. Yes. I haven't heard it described that way, but there's something psychedelic about it. It's like Bathsheba Everdeen is standing there and she's dating this soldier. She's a little bit uncertain about him. And he's taken off to some hill somewhere. And he's like, watch this. And then he starts doing some sword skills, but it's from her perspective. So he starts running towards her like he's going to stab her and then misses her right at the last minute. So it's all a bit pseudo-sexual symbolism, I suppose. But also sometimes he goes out of focus because he's running towards her. And sometimes there's light coming from behind him that, you know, bleaches out the shot and stuff, which at that time must have been quite radical. And I think that's why I say that there's a rock and roll sort of trippy vibe to it, which obviously was coming. That was what was coming for cinema. But to show that in a period piece must have been quite radical, which I suppose is why people really remember it. It's very experiential. Yeah. It's very like you feel like you are, he's running towards you and you're falling in love with him, sort of thing. Being impressed by him flashing this sword around.
You're not scared, are you?
No.
Because if you're scared, I can't perform. I promise I won't touch you. Don't move.
Is it very sharp?
No, got no edge at all. Hold still.
So your first choice has been an experimental short film that's actually turned into what's regarded as the definitive adaptation of a Thomas Hardy text. That's not a bad place to start. Do you want to introduce the second film you're bringing into the conversation? Because I think this is firmly on the Alice Lowe home ground.
Yeah, so it is related, of course, because it is the masterpiece, which is Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
Directed by Nicholas Roeg, who went from being a cinematographer into directing his own films. And it's a horror about a couple who've lost a child and they go to Venice on a sort of work trip, which they're trying to turn into a sort of romantic holiday to sort of recuperate from their loss, I suppose. And again, I saw it when I was really young, you know, kind of formative.
He's really young, like teenage years kind of thing. And it's just like...
I might have been 12 or something like that. I mean, a lot of the horror films that I've seen started out with my sister watching them because she was 4 years older than me, and then her telling me about them scene by scene. And that was one of them, was Don't Look Now.
That's an amazing sister.
Yeah. But she's quite expressive. She would literally act out the whole film, like The Shining, right. The Exorcist, all of it.
So I'm picturing the scene. In your household, there's what? You as a 12-year-old, your sister was what? A 16-year-old acting out The Shining and Don't Look Now for you.
Yeah.
Okay. I only bring that up with some expression of surprise because nobody has said those words to me ever.
Well, my dad wouldn't let me watch them because he's a teacher, so he's a bit of a stickler to the rules, you know. So he'd be like, you can't watch this. And then obviously in some way I did watch it because I sort of watched it through someone else's eyes, but I would be captivated by, I think a lot of these stories as well have got a fairy tale quality as well, which is my, you know, I like fairy tales, obviously, but I also think gives it a timeless quality when something's got a sort of simplicity to it story-wise. And I think there is something of the fairy tale about Don't Look Now and Far From the Madding Crowd. It's sort of, you know, there was a princess, she had to choose between three princes, or, you know, that's Far From the Madding Crowd. And this is sort of like this couple who their child has died. And I don't know, there's something of the parable about it. And I think I watch it now differently as a parent as well to how I would have watched it when I was a child.
Yeah, I completely get the difference between watching it as a parent and watching it as not. But you talk there about the simplicity of like the actual fundamental story, and yet the complexity of just the editing, for instance, is completely counter to that. Could you talk about that for us a little?
I mean, having watched it quite a lot and sort of analysed it as an adult, I think there's something of classical civilization about it. There's something about about fate and about how a story is always contained within someone and you're predestined to enact that story, which is a very classical ancient Greek notion. And of course they're in Venice, so it's aligned with that sort of classical civilization notion anyway. So then you've got the editing, which kind of has bits that happen at the end happening in the middle, and you know, the famous sex scene, which happens while they're actually getting dressed as well. And there's flash forwards to death and flashbacks to death. And so it's this sort of idea of like, this story was always going to happen. It's predestined. And you certainly have this sort of sense of dread throughout it. But to me, when I watch it, I think it's a lot about guilt and sort of parental guilt. And this idea that this character, this, you know, Donald Sutherland's character does have the gift of foresight. It's just that he ignores it because he's a man. Yeah. It's what I read it as. It's like someone not wanting to ask for directions in a car. It's like, oh, I'm a bit spooked out, but I'm going to ignore it because I don't pay attention to that kind of stuff. And his wife is kind of there going, but listen, there's these psychic women we met in a toilet and they're saying this, and there's all sorts of warnings. We probably shouldn't be here. And he just says that stuff and nonsense, even though he feels it, even though he has that gift, because he sort of knows that his daughter's drowning at the beginning. So he has sort of psychic powers himself. It's just that he doesn't listen to them. So it's like, I don't know, I think there's something really interesting as well about relationships in that it is sort of like this, as much as you want to believe in this sort of the difference between men and women, of like women trusting their intuition and men thinking everything's about logic and rationale. And that's the sort of little battle that's being played out in their marriage, but also in the story. So yeah, there is so much to be got from it. Every time you watch it, you get something different, I think.
I've never had anyone tell me that the moral of Don't Look Now is to pull into the Esso station, though.
And ask for directions.
And ask for directions. But do you know what? I see it plainly now that you've pointed it out.
Well, it's just when you think about him swinging around on that rope seat in the churches and sort of really gung-ho, and you're just like, oh, my God, what is he doing? You know, and it's like he's obviously trying to prove his bravado too late in the day. He didn't save his daughter from drowning. So now he's got to swing around on a rope swing high up with all these rocks, you know, these masonry falling down. So really, I think he kills himself in a way. Like, spoiler alert, but it's like he punishes himself, like he deserves to die, which again is a very classical notion of, you know, you have sinned against fate or against the gods, so you're going to have your own punishment in some way, and you can't avoid it.
I mean, can you bring Julie Christie's work into this as well? Because we talked about almost like the reluctant actor in Far From the Madding Crowd. What's the Julie Christie we meet in Don't Look Now?
I mean, again, it's such a fascinating role for her, because you do see her as this married woman. But I think it must have been quite unusual to see that kind of character still shown as being a sexual being in a way. Like, even though she'd got kids and even though they're married, they're going to have a sex scene. That's so unusual. If you think, like, what else do you see the sex scene in on camera is like a James Bond or something. And here's someone who wears tweed.
Don't knock it.
Having a sex scene in a hotel room. But, you know, I think there's something really fascinating about the way she pulls that off in a way that I don't think many actresses could, that there's a sense of sort of regality about her, but also a childlike quality, like a vulnerability, like you really see her hope that, you know, she might be able to talk to her child through these mediums.
Talk to the doctor. He says,
John, Christine is still with us.
Christine is dead, Laura. Christine is dead.
Of course. I know, but you know the two ladies in the restaurant? Well, they were watching us while we were eating. They kept staring at us. They told me this because they could see sitting between us. They could see Christine sitting between us. This is two people who we don't even know. Listen now. There's one who's blind. She's the one that can see. She's the one that has the second sight. And she's blind. She described to me Christine's red plastic Mac.
I have to go on to the admittedly well-trodden ground of just the colour scheme of Don't Look Now and the use of colour, which I think was an influence on your own film Prevenge as well, in particular.
Yeah.
Can you just bring us into that a little bit, of what you took from it, how it's informed your own work?
I mean, the thrill of doing a world premiere at the Venice Film Festival as well with my film.
Yeah, I remember
which
that.
I did actually bring up Don't Look Now. So, because I was like, I can't believe I'm here showing my film. And Don't Look Now is one of my favourite films of all time. I mean, what strikes me about it is not so much the red, which is used very sparingly, but it's more the browns and the greys and the sepia, the colours of the masonry and the stone. And then they're wearing brown as well. They're wearing brown and tweed. And, you know, their hair colour is very... it's almost sculptural or something, like they're made of stone or something. I don't know how to explain it, but there is something about the uniformity of the colour throughout it which puts you in this very strange... Do you know what? I'm thinking about it now, it's almost like they're in limbo. It's almost like Venice is a netherworld.
Oh, interesting.
And it's sort of sepia. It's like there's no colour in their lives because this has happened to them. So they're sort of...
A sort of purgatory kind of thing.
Yeah, that they're sort of halfway between life and death when they go to this place. And of course, he ends up dying, but she ends up living and leaving. And she's also pregnant, I think. It's sort of implied that she's pregnant with his baby after the sex scene. So she escapes. But I think that's something, you know, you feel that's what gives one of the really strange atmospheres, is you're in this world, you're trapped in this strange world that has a completely different quality of light and colour to what you're used to.
You sound like an absolutely fascinating person to sit next to and watch a film with.
What if I just talked all the way through, though?
Your sister would be acting it out in the corner. We've already worked that out.
But, yeah.
I mean, do you find... I wonder if it's changed since you've directed films, how you look at a film. Are you still the same Alice Lowe that you were before you went through that process?
I mean, I sometimes think about this because sometimes you think, oh, it's so depressing that I watch things a bit critically and technically now, and I wish I could watch it with just receptiveness, yeah. Complete receptiveness. Because now I do tend to go, well, who's this director? Why have they chosen them? Yeah. What, you know, I do have this inner critical voice going, you know, which I wish I could get rid of. But I do have the odd, that's when I know that I think a filmmaker is the real deal, is when you watch something and that voice disappears. You're just in the film. You're just watching it. And that does happen to me rarely. Jonathan Glazer's yes. films do that to me. They completely transport me, you know, to somewhere else.
I overheard my own true love, his voice did sound so clear.
Just before we wrap this up, the two films that you've talked about also have, both have really interesting music choices to them as well. What about Pino Donaggio's work in Don't Look Now and the use of folk songs, I think it is, in Far From the Madding Crowd?
Well, this is what I mean about the folk horror revival, that you do watch some of this stuff, especially like the circus scenes and stuff, and you do go, oh, it's creepy and it's weird and we don't think of it as that. Yeah, I mean, I think music's often thought of as an afterthought, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always fire the composer in post-production. That's the old cliche.
I think, especially with Don't Look Now, you kind of feel like it was inherent to the whole thing, to your understanding of what the piece is. And it's a personality. I always think that with my music, and I work with the same composers on my films. I think it's a mistake to sort of go generic with your music. If you go too generic, like, oh, just make this like a horror score. And my music always has to be like a character. I always think of it as like a character. It's got a personality and an identity and a perspective and a viewpoint. And it's idiosyncratic. So it's not going to be like another soundtrack. Might have some stuff that overlaps, or it might have some inspiration from somewhere, but it's going to be its own thing, so that when you hear it, you go, oh, that's the soundtrack to that, you know. And all of my favourite films do that, have soundtracks that are utterly different to other things and really stand out, because I just think it's essential, you know, especially if you're talking about something visual, where either you're going to have very heavy sound design if you're not going with more music, or you're going to have loads of music as well.
And would it be fair to say, given your family viewing, that if we were allowed to have allowed you a third film from the list as well, it would be The Elephant Man, which you cunningly segued in a little bit there.
I'm thinking a lot about The Elephant Man at the moment. I think my favourites sort of change as and when what I'm watching. I mean, actually, the thing about The Elephant Man, I looked at the script quite recently and it has got a lot of dialogue. There's an awful lot of The Elephant Man just being in his lovely rooms and some posh people coming to visit him and going, oh, are you The Elephant Man? Yes, I am. It's nice to meet you. And like, there's quite a lot of that. But I mean, the things that you remember are not those bits. It's the stuff at the circus and the stuff where he's running around trying to escape people with a bag over his head, and, you know, the bit at the end when he lies down and stuff. So, yeah, it's quite interesting for David Lynch that he had quite so much dialogue, but it's still a masterclass. Like, I think the restraint of it is what is really helping me at the moment, because I'm writing a particular project. Just the sort of sense of like how formal people would have been in the past and maybe not talked about certain things. There would be much more resistance to talking as openly as we do now. And I think that's quite interesting. We forget that quite a lot. Before you know it, everyone's just talking about the plot.
Yeah.
You know, I'm writing a period piece at the moment.
Well, which leads me on to just...
Why are they just saying everything?
My nosy curiosity before we let you go. What are you up to next, Alice Lowe? Apart from expanding the Sightseers movie universe, I still want that.
Well, the period thing I'm talking about is sort of under wraps at the moment, but I'm writing an adaptation of Midsummer Night's Dream for screen. I'm also working on another project called Sprites, which is about the brownies or in an incarnation of the Brownies, just, you know, for not allowed to call it the Brownies.
Well, I wish you the very best with those films, and thank you so much for spending time on the Studio Canal Presents podcast talking to us about your choices. Alice Lowe, you're a legend, and your sister sounds like absolute A1. Absolute A1.
She is. She is.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Both Far From the Madding Crowd and Don't Look Now can be found on disc on the Vintage Classics label. They're also both available on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Prime Video and Apple TV. We've just got time for our usual roundup of the latest goings-on in the world of Studio Canal. Heading to cinemas this autumn is a brand new drama called Pressure, telling, well, one hell of a true story with the help of an all-star cast. Andrew Scott, Damian Lewis, Kerry Condon, Brendan Fraser. Well, they head up the ensemble in a film set in the days leading up to the pivotal D-Day landing in World War II. Written by Anthony Maris and David Haig and directed by Maris, Studio Canal is releasing the film in cinemas on the 9th of September 2026. And here's a taste of the trailer.
The weather can destroy us.
I'm very proud they chose you, Jim.
Dr. James Stagg, reporting for duty.
General Eisenhower will see you now.
D-Day will be the largest seaborne invasion in history.
Churchill tells me you're the best meteorologist in the country. I need a forecast.
Our troops require perfect conditions. Any waves over 6 feet, impossible.
On home formats, meanwhile, the Oscar-winning Leaving Las Vegas is making its debut on the 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray format, following a brand new 4K restoration. Director Mike Figgis' drama stars Nicolas Cage and Elizabeth Shue, with Cage's complex, multi-award-winning performance as a man battling his alcoholism sticking long in the memory. The disc goes on sale from the 18th of May, 2026. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. Until the next time, well, I'd better go off and ask for some directions. Ta-ta for now.